So it's very normal, quote unquote, for people to kind of plateau at some point in their career in terms of their knowledge, their growth, their salary, and all of that. I think one of the things for me is like anytime I feel comfortable, I try to do something to make me feel uncomfortable, try to like push growth a little bit, whether that's the Amazon store or the nonprofit that I'm working on. You know, whatever it is, like I try to do something that pushes the envelope a little bit and forces me to grow.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Millionaire Journey podcast. I'm your host, Glenn Yaney.
The goal of this podcast is to guide and empower you on your journey towards financial independence. Today, my guest is Mustafa Lada. Welcome, Mustafa.
Thank you, Glenn. How are you doing today?
Good. Did I say the last name correctly? Or
close enough.
How would you say the last name?
It's Lada. It's a bit confusing, I know.
Yeah, no problem. And Mustafa is based out of New Jersey. Is that what you were saying earlier?
Yeah, in North Jersey.
Awesome. If you could, just tell us a little bit about your financial journey and how you got to where you're at today, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. So I went to Rutgers University, State University of New Jersey, studied genetics with a minor in religion, went to med school, decided ultimately it wasn't for me. Then I went to work in the pharmaceutical industry. At that point in time, I was in drug development. I started a couple of different businesses, scaled those, and eventually, you know, just really focused full time on real estate. That just happened to be the business that was, you know, scaling the most. And then that really more or less led me to where I am today, Glenn. So it's really just been about doubling down on my personal development, and real estate has just been the niche that has worked the best for me. It's really resonated with my goals, and it's really enabled me to build the life that I was looking for, if that makes sense.
Great. So when you say you scaled drug development, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, so it wasn't really that I scaled drug development per se. So I was working the typical employee type job where I was working in corporate America every, you know, 1 to 3 years. I was moving to different companies. I was getting promoted, managing teams, things of that nature. And on the side, I was running different businesses. So I had, at one point, I was probably running like 3 or 4 different businesses. 2 of them were real estate focused. Those were the businesses that were scaling the fastest. So then ultimately, about a year ago, I quit drug development and just went full time in real estate, quote unquote. But before that, I was working, you know, over 80 hour weeks in just between my day job and my real estate business that I was running. So it's been a grind, but at the same time, it's nice because I enjoy working. I enjoy what I do. And it's really enabled me to pursue different passion projects and things of that nature.
Yeah, sometimes it's easy to overlook the previous position or the job. I think for me, that job laid the foundation of structure and how to, you know, I look back on how things were done with that company that I worked for. How do you think that that previous position working for the pharmaceutical company has helped you grow your real estate business?
It's helped a lot in the sense that I had a lot of people around me that are entrepreneurs. And sometimes when you look at an entrepreneur, you know, 20 years into their career, it kind of can feel like they're doing whatever they want and they have the schedule that they want to have. But I don't think some people differ. But in my approach in life, like you want structure and you want to build the structure so that eventually you can do what you want and you have the right foundation to do that. Mm-hmm. But if you go in doing that day one, I don't think you'll scale as efficiently. And that was one of the big reasons why I started in corporate America, was just because I wanted to learn that structure. I wanted to understand how people do business differently and then really incorporate that to really build out the businesses that I wanted to. So to your point, Glenn, I think fundamentally working for somebody else, working in corporate America, it not only gives you that structure, that foundation, but it kind of helps you benefit from the good aspects of having a W-2 job, having that stable income, having that 401k, having that employer healthcare plan, all of those things kind of reduce your cost, enable you to build up a nest egg to then be hyper aggressive or moderately aggressive in building your business, which is a risk, right? It's a risk worth taking. You're investing in yourself. I would 100% recommend entrepreneurship. But at the end of the day, if you can build out a structure where you're mitigating risk, then that's, you know, more ideal to some degree. And that's really what I did, right? Sure. I mean, there's opportunity costs in every situation.
Yeah.
But then every time you change jobs, you can take your 401k, you can put it in a self-directed IRA, you can invest that. And there's so many different strategies that you can do by being an employee and an entrepreneur at the same time. But the trade-off is you're sacrificing time. And I would recommend doing it while you're young and you have more free time. And then that way, you know, ultimately you can build out that life that you're looking for.
Yeah. So also with for me, I had this, I actually have left my W-2 job to go try to do some entrepreneurial things. And then I came back to the W-2 because I don't know if it's considered failure, but it's just understanding my risk tolerance. Yeah. And a lot of people would say like what I'm doing now would be pretty, feel to them would be risky. But what I had to do to be able to leave my job, mm-hmm. what I learned is that my first time I left, I didn't have a income foundation to back up me leaving, you know? So I left maybe with like 30 grand in my bank account trying to start a business. And that wasn't gonna, with no income, that 30 grand will go very quickly.
Yeah.
And you know, the second time I did it, I had some type of income, and that's where that W-2 really helps. The other thing I would say with the W-2 that helped me as well is having a consistent paycheck. When you're out there trying to do the entrepreneur thing, it's like once you get a good deal, you don't know if you're going to get another one coming, you know?
No, I hear you. I agree absolutely, Glenn. And I think that's why it comes down to understanding risk tolerance.
Yeah.
But to some degree, in my humble opinion, there's no real course on understanding risk tolerance. It's experience based.
Yes.
And then you only know if you have a high risk tolerance when like the chips are down or the market is red or the company's not doing well and you're like, okay, I'm going to invest more capital or I'm going to invest more time. I'm going to go double down or I'm going to kind of scale back and pivot. And to your point, I don't think there's really failure in life, Glenn. I don't really look at it as like pass fail. I think that's very like, you know, in school there's pass fail, but then, you know, your performance in school doesn't always translate to your performance in life.
Yeah.
I think what it is, hey, I had a setback. How can I turn that quote unquote wasted year or wasted 3 months, 6 months, 100K, whatever it is. How can I turn that into a learning opportunity or an opportunity to scale even more aggressively? Like I've had situations where I've pivoted and started other businesses and they've done quote unquote well. And then I've still shut them down because I've been like, hey, this is using too much of my time and the opportunity cost elsewhere is much higher. Or there have been businesses where they're like struggling to survive, struggling to have cash flow, and you're learning the business and you're looking at it saying, hey, you know, maybe I should have looked at the viability earlier, but what's like my max earning potential in this business? If I'm devoting 24/7 of my life to this business, maybe I'll only make 500K a year. Maybe that's not worth it versus another industry where you can scale even higher. And to your point, Glenn, I think there's no better teacher than experience. You know, it's ideal to learn from other people's experiences. That way you don't have to waste your own time. And that's why we listen to a podcast like Millionaire Journey to learn from, you know, your experiences and things of that nature to, you know, just help us scale faster.
Yeah. So if we could just talk about some of the businesses that maybe you started and the thought process on what you did to decide to close it to move on to something else. I think that's a good thought experiment, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Sure. So a couple of years back, I was working in the pharmaceutical industry. I was a senior position in drug development and I was quote unquote leading my own team. And I had my real estate company as well, where I'm investing in multifamily real estate. So both businesses were both jobs. One was a business, one was a job, W-2 job. Both were doing well. And then I thought to myself, oh, hey, I really want to start an Amazon company. Because, you know, why not? Everyone starts Amazon companies and they're quote unquote easy and everyone can make money and, you know, Instagram or TikTok or whatever it is. And it's something that I've thought about for, you know, many years. So I pulled the trigger. I started a company and I started selling on Amazon. At one point, like I myself was shipping out like 400 boxes a day on top of all the other stuff I was doing. It was not a useful, you know, use of my time at all. And this was like peak COVID, right? So it was great. We made great revenue. We made great profit as well. Because in Amazon, a lot of times people talk about revenue. They don't talk about bottom line profit. So it can be very deceptive. We were doing well. We were doing six figures. So I can't complain necessarily. But fundamentally, it wasn't, you know, a good use of my time. And it took a lot to get to that point because the way I was looking at it, Glenn, is I like to bootstrap. So I like to, quote unquote, pay less and do the work myself. And that's the problem to some degree as you scale, because you need to build the right systems. You need to kind of hire the right people. You need to outsource, train people, whatever it is. It's not always going to be like in Amazon situation, fulfillment by merchant where I'm shipping it out myself, or fulfillment by Amazon where Amazon is shipping it out. Each model has different, you know, scaling potential. Fulfillment by Amazon is more expensive, but it's also leveraging Amazon's infrastructure. So in a lot of situations, net-net, it can be actually cheaper. It just depends on how you go about the business and what you're selling. So ultimately for me, Glenn, I was looking at it like, hey, I'm, you know, I have my W-2 job. Things are going well there. I have my real estate stuff. Things are going well there. I have Amazon. Things are going well, but I'm spending way too much time. And, you know, when you read these business books or you talk to people, they talk about like the 80-20 rule. I would say probably 80% of my work was going into this, and maybe that was giving like 20% revenue. I don't think those are exact accurate numbers, but the easiest way for me to say it in different words is I was spending way too much time to not make enough money. So then I had to look at it and say, hey, fundamentally, is this worth me scaling? Is it worth hiring the right people to do it, to have them do it? Or would that eat up all the profit margin? And if it eats up all the profit margin, is this business really that scalable? Maybe let's kind of slow down. We'll focus on real estate, which is much more scalable. And either way, it's going, you know, well. You know, this might have been the passion project. It might have been something that I wanted to do that I was passionate about. But having done it for 1-2 years, whatever it was, I'm at a point where I think it's not as scalable for me right now. And to get to that next point, I would have to change strategies in terms of what I'm buying, which is fine. It's not a problem. But it's fundamentally about the time it would take to restructure things. And ultimately, Glenn, to your point about like failures and setbacks and stuff, Amazon is still something I would go back to, right? Like people talk to me about how can I make money? Amazon is one of those options that's great. If you have no money and you want to get start making some money, you can definitely do it with Amazon, in my opinion, even in 2024. But ultimately for me, it didn't make the most sense for me to continue to spend my time there because I had other opportunities that were much more lucrative. Does that kind of make sense, Glenn?
Yeah, what I was actually kind of thinking, it goes with a lot of things, but if you've watched anything on YouTube, you'll find out about dropshipping. And I think there's a time in some people's lives that it's more feasible to do. And I think if you have a high income, like say a high income earning job, it turns into what's the best use of your time leverage wise. You know, sometimes like that's when, whether you're a limited partner in an investment or if you're actually the guy finding deals. I mean, we have guys that own multi-million dollar businesses that invest with us, and for them to buy in real estate would be a terrible use of their time, you know? But there's guys like, I guess you and I, is just that's kind of what we've spearheaded as our business and obviously had to bootstrap. It might not make a lot of money on the front end, but over time, the scalability works for our schedule is what I would say. But I kind of think about that with the house hacking thing. And I believe I've done my own personal house hack, but it's not been the conventional move into a house that has multiple units or whatever the case be, because I have, at that time I had a family, and there was one time I almost moved into the hood and to find a duplex. And today it would have been a great deal. It would have been a great deal if I would have followed through. But I'm like thinking to myself, is my wife going to be able to walk the dog in this area without being messed with, you know, by somebody?
Yeah. And the thing is, that's not on the pro forma.
Exactly. And I'm like, well, hey, our housing would be covered. And I'm like, but I don't know if this would work for my housing situation type thing. And
yeah, for my mental health, for my marital health, those are also not on the pro forma. So I think I agree with you, Glenn, in the sense that it's not something that you can get on a sales call or a pitch or a conversation and tell somebody, hey, is this worth your time?
Yeah.
Because for them, you know, people don't always think of their time in monetary numbers, and they should. But when it comes to scaling your portfolio, anyone can go and buy real estate. You could go on Zillow and buy a house. That doesn't mean it's an investment property. That doesn't mean it's going to make you money. What you're indirectly gaining when you work with somebody like yourself, Glenn, or myself, is the years of experience that we spent perfecting our craft. Like for me, if you want to talk opportunity zones, you want to talk investing in the Northeast, those are my strengths. That's where I make clients a lot of money. And then this other stuff I do is like on the side. Like I talk about financial literacy on the side because I'm passionate about it. I talk about, you know, all these different businesses because there's so many ways to make money. And the only like limiting factor is our creativity.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's kind of how I found you, is through LinkedIn. I think you were commenting about personal finances, and that's kind of like my thing. I could read like 20 books on compound interest. It could be the same topic and like how you figure it out and what you do.
I love it.
And I can read posts about it all day. And I think one of your posts were kind of talking about investing and personal finance, and that's my thing, but also real estate. One thing I read on your bio, which was interesting, I guess if you could just go into what you invest in and kind of the structure of your thought process on how you get to what you purchase.
Sure, sure. So we invest in a lot of ground up construction opportunities. So typically what we'll do is we'll go in, we'll buy a single family house, we'll rezone the land, we'll demolish the property, we'll build an apartment complex, and then we'll refinance. So obviously it's not just me, I have a team, you know, a co-GP structure. I've been doing it for over a decade now. So now with that, there's a lot of different ways that, you know, investors can get involved. We have Reg D structures that are for accredited investors only. We have a debt fund, like an income fund, which is like a fixed return product. We have an equity fund that's, you know, more of a profit share product. Then we have a Reg A Tier 2, which basically means it's open to anybody. So accredited, non-accredited, you can invest with as little as $5,000. There, it's an 80-20 profit split with a 2% management fee. So it's pretty, you know, investor friendly. The goal is just to lower the barrier of entry as low as possible, right? That way everyone can get started. They can kind of see performance. And then based on that, they can compare it to their other asset classes and they can see how they want to scale. Because a lot of times what I've noticed, Glenn, in real estate is sometimes the barrier to enter is very high. You know, you're talking like 100K, 25K is considered low, but accredited only. So the goal with this, you know, Reg A structure is that anyone can get started. You can do retirement capital, non-retirement capital. You could do leverage your HELOC, leverage your life insurance. There's so many different strategies out there. But fundamentally, it's just about understanding, you know, what we're investing in, why we're in the Northeast, why we find it attractive. And then if it resonates with investors, great. If not, more than happy to be a resource for people and just help them along their journey.
Yeah, so with the structures that you have there, because I've heard about them, and I've, like, I guess let's go into the debt one. Kind of like, what does it invest in? It doesn't have to talk about one specific one, but maybe like, what kind of structure is it based on? Like, how do you get paid as an investor and something like that?
Yeah, good question. Good question. So obviously this is just for, you know, this would be where I talk about disclaimers. This is just for educational purposes. We're not talking about actually investing or anything like that.
Yes.
But basically the debt fund, or what we refer to as the income fund, is it's structured as a promissory note.
Yeah.
So you're lending money to the fund and the fund is lending money to developers. Investors are making anywhere from 10 to 13% a year. They can be paid monthly, quarterly, semi-annual, or annual. Mm-hmm. So it's a great option for people getting started. It's a one-year investment minimum. So it's a quote-unquote, in real estate terms, it's highly liquid.
Yeah.
And the goal is to get your feet wet and to get cash flow if you're looking for that. The downside from my perspective as an investor is that income is you get a 1099 at the end of the year. So it's high taxable income. Mm-hmm. So it's really, when I look at it, it's, hey, do I want that monthly cash flow or not? And then you'd say, okay, hey, I don't want the monthly cash flow. I'm fine with yearly cash flow. Then you talk about something like an equity fund. Again, just for education purposes, that is structured as this 80-20 with a 2% management fee. And that has a 2-year minimum investment period with annual payout options. So what that means is the investor can elect to receive profit annually, or they can elect to compound it. Just like you were talking about compound growth. Ultimately, a lot of our clients, that's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
They're looking at it like, hey, I want this to grow long term. The downside is around this time, we're in March 2024, around April time, your taxes are due. So if you're compounding your return every year, you're making money. So you owe taxes, but you didn't receive that money in your pocket.
Mm.
One of those things that for investors, you know, I do my best to kind of tell them all of these pitfalls ahead of time. That way they can kind of budget, right? Because no one wants like a 3K tax bill or whatever when you haven't budgeted for it per se. But still, in general, most people prefer to reinvest their profit. Then you have more customized things like syndications, where instead of the fund where it's diversified, you're in one single asset in the syndication or 6 specific assets. And then it's like, you know, the strategy could be like a 20-year hold. It could be, you know, that in the first 3 years, you're refinancing and getting all your money back. And after that, it's just infinite return. And then let's say 20 years down the line, you're going to do a 1031 exchange. Like, that's a different strategy. Or it could be, you know, ground up construction, build to sell. That's also a different strategy. So a lot of times it comes down to the client, what their goals are, where the money is coming from. If it's coming from a retirement account, it's already tax advantaged. So then we want those high ROI short-term deals because they're not getting taxed. So it's compounding tax-free.
Yeah. So with that, the one that you were talking about, I think it was the second fund, you were saying that where, you know, if they could keep their investment, rolled it in, is the reason why it would be taxed is because inside the fund, it kind of like, it's a choice to leave your funds in there, or, and then some investors in the fund are taking a payout and then some are not. So what they do is they just dividend, like a, almost like a dividend reinvestment. Is that what it, that kind of works?
Yeah, I think that would be the easiest way to understand it, Glenn. In that fund,
yeah,
you're an owner of the fund.
Yeah.
Right. So you're owner of the fund, which is basically a company. You own the company made money. So somebody's got to pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it is if you own 1% of the company, you made 1% of the profit the company made. So you pay taxes on that 1%, but you might elect to reinvest it. Just like if you had a company, an individual solo company that's yours that you made money in,
mm-hmm.
just because you didn't take the money to your personal bank account doesn't mean that the company didn't make money. The company still owes those taxes. And that's kind of how it works, Glenn, if that makes sense.
So in your investment approach, wouldn't is in your deals are more development, correct?
So we have both, but yeah, most of it is development. We have a lot of value add as well, but it's like, you know, new construction that doesn't really have much CapEx. Yeah. And really the play is just to access that trapped equity, right? Because you're buying in at a massive discount versus appraised value. So it's, hey, we built it at $10. It's worth $15, we'll sell you some equity at a value of $13, right? So that's, you know, to keep it simple, because the cost of construction is so much lower than the actual value of the asset, there's equity there. So it's looking at it saying, hey, fundamentally, what is our strength? Our strength is ground up construction. There aren't a lot of players like that in our space, in our market. So we can go to the bank and we can get our 70% LTV or 65% LTV, but then there's still 30 to 35% equity trapped. So what if we sell some of that equity to investors? What does that look like? And how attractive can we make it to investors so that they come in an equity ownership position? They get a preferred return until refinance. At refinance, which is projected to be in year 3, they get all their money back plus profit. They continue to own the asset. And then we're telling investors, like, listen, we're not looking to sell this asset for the next 10, 20 years. This is a long-term investment. But the goal is to get your money out as quickly as possible. That way, you know, it's just an infinite returns at that point.
So before we go any further, I would just say these are just theoretical explanations. And
exactly.
And there's always risk. And none of these are, you know, you have to do your own due diligence, what I would say. But going into the development part, the part back to the taxing, I think when you're fixing up a place and say you're buying into one of these, wouldn't it just constantly be losses, even if you're receiving a dividend? And then that would just be considered like a return of capital or slash like just because of all the depreciation that you're, you know, the money going into it. I mean, we're not tax advisors, but I would say, wouldn't that be more of like a tax-free event where you wouldn't have to pay taxes on it?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It really comes down to the structure and what we're doing in the fund.
Yeah.
Right. In that first example, you're making that monthly income.
Yeah.
It's a 1099. Mm-hmm. There's no way around that. You're paying taxes.
Yeah.
At least I'm not a CPA. This is not tax advice, but in my limited knowledge, you're paying taxes.
Yeah.
In the second one, in the second fund, you can get very creative.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, it depends on what the fund is investing in. In that fund, typically, we're doing ground up construction. Build to sell. Because we're selling, we're realizing those taxable events. Now, in another strategy, in that third syndication strategy where we're holding, because we're holding, we're projecting a negative K-1. So the real savvy, like shark investors that are looking to make as much as possible, they'll do option 2 and option 3.
Yes.
They'll have option 3 with the negative K-1. Write off option 2 is positive K-1.
Ah, that makes sense. Yep.
Because they're not real estate professionals, and most people aren't. So most people can't, you know, take an active deduction against their, they can't use a passive investment to actively write off active income. So what they'll do is they'll take two passive investments and have them write each other off, so to speak. And again, this isn't tax advice, obviously I'm not a CPA, but it's to say, hey, how creative can we get to really supercharge our growth?
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. So I guess the next thing I did see in your bio that the way you guys invest, it was a certain type of investment process based on morals and stuff like that. If you could just talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So some investors, you know, they invest in a manner that's called like Sharia compliance.
Uh-huh.
So Sharia compliance typically means they're not investing in alcohol, pork, you know, different kind of products. And with respect to real estate, it also means they're not investing with any interest or loans. So one of our funds, that's our equity fund, the reason why we sell, because, you know, from our perspective, we're creating like core amazing assets in a great market. There's no reason to sell from like a high level traditional perspective. But the reason to sell is some people from a religious perspective, they can't have any exposure to loans or interest. So because of that, there's a certain sect, certain group of investors that want to invest on an all cash basis. And this fund is really built out around those ideals and that mentality to say, how can we structure it so that people are investing on an all cash basis? This is an actual performance. This is hypothetical and educational, but we're making double digit returns every year. So they're, you know, their money is compounding and they don't have to be in a product that they don't want to be in because they can't go for those tax advantaged options because they have mortgages.
Yeah.
And there's no mortgage product for multifamily assets that aligns with that religious belief of, you know, Sharia compliance, at least not that I'm aware of. So really it's about understanding like one specific group's needs and catering products and services around that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can, not that I have that, I guess there's some morals that I have ran into that I've learned not to do. So I could tell you one investment I made one time is I bought credit card debt. It was about eight-year-old credit card debt. And it was like from Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
It was something crazy. Like, I think it was like $17 million of credit card debt. And I paid for $17,000 for it. And I'm like, if I collect on like two or three of these, I'll make money back.
Uh-huh.
And as I was like telling people about this, I was like, this is total predatory. In my opinion, it was like predatory like type investing. And I was like, but I'm going to get rich is what I thought to myself.
Uh-huh.
And little did I know that it is a tough, it was a tough market, credit card collections and not knowing anything about it. You know, 8 years means that the debt's charged off. So I ended up being able to sell the portfolio back to some, I collected $1,000 on my $17 million portfolio of loans and bad debt. And then I sold the rest of it for $6,000. So I put in $17,000 and came back with seven with my tail between my legs. And it was one of those times where I thought there's two lessons that I learned when I did that. I was like, for one, I should never invest in something I don't know nothing about. And that was kind of like collecting on credit card debt that's whatever, 7 or 8 years old, terrible idea for somebody that has no idea what they're doing. And then two, I thought about certain people that I knew that were close to me that could have been on that list.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, do I want to be that person trying to collect from those people, you know? And the debt was like 2000, the time frame was like 2008 to 2010 time frame. It was terrible. But yeah, I could understand the religious aspect of not doing certain investments like that.
And then like from the other person's perspective, right, you can view it as like, no, they owe this. It's their moral obligation or it's their responsibility to pay it. And there's to some degree, when you're having this conversation, I think there's no, like, it's not my place to judge, number one.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm more of the opinion that, you know, I listen and I provide options, right? If somebody wants to invest in this credit thing, I would say, listen, it looks very interesting, looks very exciting. I'm skeptical. So if you're going to do it, use a self-directed IRA.
Yeah.
Either way, you can't access that money till you're 65. You know, if you make your 1 million, you make your, you know, 6 million, whatever it is, you know, then it's tax-free. Like, you know, or it's tax deferred, right? You pay a lot less in taxes and then it'll compound. So like I have an investment like similar to this that was like NFTs. Maybe a couple of years ago, you know, everyone and their mother was buying NFTs. I was speaking to somebody and he was saying, yeah, you know, there's these ape NFTs. They're going to go wild. And I'm like, listen, this is going to waste money. If you want to waste money, sure. Here's some money from my self-directed IRA. Go waste money, go learn and come back to me. I don't know where those NFTs are. I have a lost poet and some ape thing. It's somewhere in the metaverse or something. And all I know is, you know, it's gone down to zero. And that was fine because, you know, sometimes you have to go through that experience to learn, right? And like your story, it's one of those things that sometimes it's impactful because you hear it and you can understand what that person went through. So you don't have to make that mistake. Other times, you know, everyone's different. Some people need to like lose money or like haven't heard the story yet. So in this situation, based on the person I was speaking to, I said, yeah, sure. No problem. here's some money from my self-directed IRA, go invest it, knowing with like a 99% degree of confidence that he's going to lose this money. And it's going to be okay, because hopefully every so often I'll tell him about it and it'll kind of, you know, stop larger losses in the future.
Yeah. To add to the story is I also bought, full disclosure, I bought Bitcoin at 63,000 and then it went down to like 20.
Okay.
And then it got to a point, it got up to 30 and I was just like, you know what? I should have never put my money in this thing. And I sold it at 30.
Uh-huh.
And then within a month, it's back to 60,000. So it's, I could have made my money back, but it was like back to my investing principles. We're talking about risk.
Yeah.
And we just have to know what our investing approach is. And we just have to, in my opinion, stick to it, you know, knowing what I'm getting into.
And it's easier said than done, right? Like I gave that example of Amazon. We've given a couple of different examples.
Yeah.
I think fundamentally at some point you just look back and you say like, we make a plan and God laughs, right? Like,
yes.
Yep. You know, look at it. We say, okay, hey, Bitcoin is going to be the future. Let me dollar cost average. Let me do this. Let me do that. And then you left it on an exchange and the exchange got hacked.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, BlockFi goes bankrupt. You know, things happen where, you know, you might be comfortable with leverage. So you say, okay, hey, there's this established platform. Let me put my money there and let me let it leverage and it'll compound and grow. And then you end up losing everything. So it's one of those things, I think, to your point, Glenn, it's like you want to keep different buckets, so to speak, and you want to understand your strategy for different buckets. If you're offensive on every single bucket, it might not be the right play. And I say that, like, I have a high risk tolerance. And I say that because it's important, like, I'm saying myself first, that not every investment needs to be offensive. Some of them need to be defensive. And it's very important to look at that. And that's why I love real estate, right? Fundamentally, the reason I invest in New Jersey is because it's such a strong market right outside New York City. It's the most densely populated state in the country. The market we invest in has most inventory is from pre-1940s. So it's very old inventory. It's very pro-rezoning. It's, you know, there's a lot of opportunity zones in our market. So there's a lot of tax benefits. So if that's my solid base, that's where I'm doing very well. Fundamentally, going through all these different experiences kind of teaches you that diversification is very important. To your point, Glenn, you want to invest in things that you know and understand. And when you're diversifying into other assets that maybe you don't understand, that's where it's important to find somebody like a Glenn, somebody like a Mustafa to say, hey, this person knows buying credit card debt. This person knows Amazon store. This person knows cryptocurrency. Let them manage some of my capital because I'm paying for their experience. And I think that you can only realize that by going through these experiences and saying, hey, what did I do wrong? What could I have done better to make money? Because people are making money in credit card debt.
Yeah, they do.
Somebody yesterday that was saying the same thing. And I was like, bro, I don't know about credit card debt. And he's like, no, this guy has the connection. He knows the infrastructure. He buys this. And so then it becomes like, you know, playing Monopoly. I said, okay, fine. Enjoy. That's his area. That's what he knows. You know, who am I to say otherwise?
But also through the, when I hear you say that you have a high risk tolerance, I think it's not to be underestimated that you also know a lot about development, I would imagine, into the New York, New Jersey location and the areas of strong demand along with that.
Yeah, I agree, Glenn. And I think the counterpoint is that I didn't always know a lot.
Yeah.
That you learn by doing in life. And a lot of times it's, especially like from my background, right? It's very easy to say, hey, you have a W-2 job, you start out making less money, you grow in your profession, and you reach a point where you're making, quote unquote, a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And in theory, your life gets more expensive. You get married, you have kids, or whatever, inflation. Life gets more expensive, right? So it's very normal, quote unquote, for people to kind of plateau at some point in their career in terms of their knowledge, their growth, their salary, and all of that. I think one of the things for me is like anytime I feel comfortable, I try to do something to make me feel uncomfortable, try to like push growth a little bit, whether that's the Amazon store or the nonprofit that I'm working on. You know, whatever it is, like I try to do something that pushes the envelope a little bit and forces me to grow. And I think, Glenn, that would be my advice to people is always invest in yourself, you know, to the best of your ability. If that means reading multiple books on compound interest, do it. If that means, you know, listening to the podcast that focuses on people's journeys, do that. Because indirectly, you might learn one strategy, like investing your retirement money in real estate, which most people don't know exists, or, you know, investing your HSA money in real estate, which less than 2% of people do. These different, you know, strategies that I'm mentioning off the cuff are things that it's worth learning about, because then ultimately it enables you to take control of your capital and ultimately build out, you know, your retirement how you want it to be.
Awesome. Well, Mustafa, we will have all your contact information in the show notes. I'll also tag you in the post that we post all of our content. And we appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Len. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Millionaire Journey podcast. Please rate, like, subscribe, leave a comment, and share with somebody you'd think would benefit from listening. Till then, see you next week.